Welcome back to another episode of The Palace Way. Kind of emotional. Final couple of games of the season to cover, but doing it all with me is someone we haven't had on the pod for a while. Hope you're all well. I'm Alex, and I'm pleased to introduce Luke Weezer-Seashell back to the pod. How are you doing, mate?
Yeah, mate, I'm good. I'm buzzing. It was a lot more depressing back when I was back on here. So to, be able to talk a bit more about the good football we've been playing and all that is really enjoyable. And yeah, I'm all good.
Really good to have you back. I mean, we were in the trenches when we last spoke. I mean, it was a bit of a chaotic summer, bit of a lull period in many ways as well. But obviously, with the continuum of Hodgson, I think that there was a lot to unpack there. So, very interesting period. But I'm absolutely relieved to see you again. Really nice catching up with you at Wolves away as well. Football with the sunshine. We'll have plenty on that later. But just for those that haven't maybe caught on to some of the episodes we did with you a while ago, I mean, we're talking probably like 15, 20 episodes now, aren't we? It's kind of embarrassing. I don't know how long ago it is since we last had you on. We've been trying to find a good time for ages. But for those that don't know about you and about what you've done with the Palace Way, could you tell us a bit about your overall background, about your relationship with Palace, where it all started, and just a bit about what you're up to at the moment with us?
Yeah, no, I'll go through this quickly, but been a Palace fan. Sometimes I say a decade, but then I forget like a decade was like 4 years ago, so it's now like closer to 15 years I've been following them. I'm just trying to stay young. But it's been really good. Season ticket, getting to a bunch of away games as well. Really enjoyable. And yeah, did a few podcasts with you back, let's say like 4 or 5 months ago or something like that, helping out the Palace Way in the background with some little things and excited post summer. And for next season to see what the Palace Way does, for sure.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's an interesting time. We're recording on the 23rd, which is a lot later than we would have liked. So we had to put out a statement, as I'm sure our listeners would have seen on Twitter, just apologising for that delay. But it's good to finally be here. And I think it's kind of nice in many ways to have the benefit of retrospect looking at these two games. So just for the benefit of listeners, we're doing a kind of Midland special here. We're very much looking at the games from recent news items. This is not our end of season review. I really want to stress that. We've got an exciting lineup of guests on the way. Some people you'll be aware of, some you won't. All of them will be names in various ways associated with either the Palace Way or the wider community, and we're really excited to have them on. We've got all sorts to look at in our end of season review, so keep it tuned in a few weeks for that, and we'll have all the details on our socials for that. But without further ado, I actually want to start with a few news items, which is something we don't normally do before we look at Wolves and then Villa respectively. I think let's just start with the headlines here. I mean, obviously the Euros is around the corner. Looking forward to a summer of beer gardens, great weather, unless you're like me and in Manchester, which I never mention on any episodes famously. But yeah, really looking forward to the Euros. And obviously, it wouldn't be Palace without a few surprises. But we had not one, not two, but four Palace players getting called up in Eberieze, Adam Wharton, Dean Henderson, and Mark Guéhi. Tarik Mitchell as well, probably unlucky not to get into the squad given the sort of injury and form, respectively, of Trippier, Shaw, and Chilwell. He hasn't missed a game this season, and that consistency is phenomenal. Luke, just talk to me about what it means to you. Just more like initial reaction here to see four Palace players in the squad. Just for context, that's as many as City and Liverpool, and no club has more players than us joint with those teams in the England squad. What does that mean to you?
Yeah, it's just an amazing feeling. It doesn't matter that it's a provisional squad. It's still a call up. It's ridiculous. Hopefully we get to see them involved in the games before the Euros. They can try and get in that final squad. That'd be amazing. But, just to see where we were in March and to see where we are now and have four Palace players called up, never could have expected it. And it's just really nice to see the way that our club can work when it does work at its best. And it's really good to see. And of course, I think Ed Ahrens tweeted like the first time since 91 that we've had four players called up to the England squad. So making new history and all that, it's just lovely to see.
I mean, just on my point there about Tyrone Mitchell as well, I mean, it's fascinating as it is for the other guys, and I don't want to take away from that. I mean, they've had terrific seasons, but, do you think Tyrone Mitchell was unlucky not to be in that squad?
Yeah, of course. I think Luke Shaw's touch and go, as Southgate said, to make the Euros. He's not going to be in the FA Cup final. If I was a Man United fan and he's misses the final and then he's back for the Euros, you're just going to be stressed that he's not actually going to be fit for the Premier League next season. I think it's a risk for all parties that he's the only left back going to the Euros. Trippier is clearly not fit. Harry Maguire's not fit. I know they're not all left backs, but Tyrique Mitchell, just a fully fit English fullback who has been on form the last few months, to get in that provisional squad, I thought it would have been a no-brainer. But Gareth Southgate, I think this message kind of says that Gareth Southgate doesn't rate him. That's really sad because he would have been the academy product making it into that England squad. So it's really sad on that side of things. Let's hope Tyreek can change his mind next season.
Definitely. His last two caps came in May 22, by the way. So it's been quite a few years now. But I mean, the fact that we're even talking about him as an England international is something in itself. But yeah, Tyrone Mitchell, obviously, probably some of the best form of his career, I would argue. I think defensively, particularly in his one-on-one situations, the data and the eye test have both been pretty strong for him. He's been locking up wingers. And even offensively in this kind of new left wing back role, he's been phenomenal. Let's give a credit to the main man, because as you mentioned, I think we were talking about a very different time in recent Palace history when we last had you on the pod. So, the transformation under Oliver Glasner is incredibly well documented online, in the papers, in this podcast. It's something I'm not going to dwell too much on, but I mean, how much credit does that man deserve for the amount of players that we're seeing in the England squad at the moment?
Look, like you, Gay would probably still get in it if Hodgson was still here. So I'd probably say for three of them, he gets the full credit. And maybe Eze could have got in under Hodgson because he's done that recently under Vieira as well. But, Glasner's got to get so much credit. I think when he came in, everyone was excited, but no one could have expected him to get 6 wins out of 7, get us playing attacking football. For me, when I saw like a five at the back formation, you never see it as exciting as we've seen it under Glasner. Like, it's still really good attacking football. That was my one worry. Like, could we still be entertaining? We are playing such good football. Everyone's scoring. He's getting the best out of every player in that squad. It's just something I never ever pictured a manager could do. And it just shows, I think, the quality of Glasner. He is a top tier manager. And no matter what happens over the next few years, I think we're going to have many, many great memories of him.
I'm genuinely scared about losing him already. It's so early in his Palace career, and I'm already thinking about the day where we have to inevitably say goodbye for one reason or another. I'm hoping it's because, someone comes and poaches him for a silly amount of money, rather than because, form dips and he suddenly falls off, or, he has a punch out with Parrish or Dougie Freeman and suddenly walks. But yeah, I mean, we'll have to kind of park that, because, I'd love to spend all day just evangelizing about Glasner, but we'll get there. I want to kind of just park that before we get onto our games. But we do need to talk about some of the headlines, unfortunately. I say unfortunately like that's a bad thing. It really isn't. Just a bit on Eze's form. He's got 17 goals in his last 36. I mean, how phenomenal is that? I mean, his goal return is something that's increasingly improved as he's been with the club for longer and longer. And I feel like Glasner's taking him to new heights again. So was he kind of a shoo-in for that squad when you think about the likes of, Maddison and other people that are competing for that place?
Yeah, I think what really works for Eze is we've been putting him in that kind of left wing free roam position, which is actually something that Southgate needs. A lot of the attacking mids that you're suggesting there, they will be having to play probably left wing at points for England if they're going to play. Maddison's been off form for months. In my opinion, he doesn't deserve it. Gordon's a really good option for England as well. Grealish has been off form. Obviously, we've seen Rashford dropped, and that's given me hope that that Eze could make that last 25-man squad. But Eze offers something that not many players do, and that is on the ball quality, being able to get past the player. We don't see that enough in modern football, but with Eze, when he's on the ball, it's ridiculous what he can do. And I think he fully deserves to get into that final squad. Hopefully he does, and hopefully, if I see like a Maddison in there over an Eze, I'm going to be so disappointed.
Me too. I mean, Maddison for me, I do rate him a lot. I think technically he's superb, but I think, a combination of injury form and actually a lack of speed and agility sometimes, I think, hinders him. He has it in bursts, but I don't think he's pacey like Eze or Foden or other options. So I think it was a bit of a surprise, but I think it's nice to be in a situation where we're talking about an abundance of quality overall. And on that note, I want to use the word, or phrase, I should say, X factor, because this is something we saw Olise getting used a lot in the media as well, and that was all bandied around him and the lack of call up for France from Olise. But actually, I think Eze is very much someone who offers that too. Let's talk about X factor, because Michael Olise, as I said, wasn't called up for France. A lot of speculation, actually, by Southgate's own admission as well, that he's someone that England have been tracking. Remember, he's still eligible for England, France, Nigeria, or Algeria. He hasn't actually been capped at a senior level yet. And there has to be a shout that we should be persuading him, maybe not, we can't do it in time for the Euros, can we? But in time for the next major tournament, that we should be persuading him to change his registration. I mean, do you think Eze should be called up for England one day?
I would love to see that. I think all Palace fans know how good Elise is. Neutral fans, I don't think, know as much how high his ceiling actually is. It is the highest ceiling I've ever seen from a Palace player since we've been in the Premier League, in my opinion. But sadly, I just think he wants France. I think that's the move he prefers. And I think even if we try, he's not going to take it. I think even if he's not in this Olympic squad over the summer, I think he's someone who will be like, look, I'll be in that France squad in a couple years anyways, so it doesn't really matter to me. I just think that's where his heart lies, to be honest. Even though he was born in Hammersmith, but
He feels the most English of all those countries, but that's not for me to say. I think the way he, that's his decision. And I think if I'm Michael Olyse, I think the whole thing with France is that in his head, France is the highest pinnacle of world football in terms of squad quality, in terms of superstars. I think for him, it's just got something that England doesn't. I think in terms of your Mbappe, in terms of your overall technical quality, but all levels of the pitch, whether it's in goal, whether it's up top, everything in between, I think he simply sets himself to that standard. I think that's genuinely why he guns for France so much. I think it's because he sees France as the crème de la crème of the world. And I think that's what he visualizes himself, which maybe I'm kind of extrapolating here, but I feel like that's a real testament to his own ambition, how he rates himself and how mature he is in terms of wanting to grow into that and not necessarily letting anything get in that way. So in some ways, I have to admire it, but I really do think of someone of his, as I say, X factor, we should be looking to make that call, to make those persuasive arguments to say, look, you've got a real shot here of competing with Saka even and really sort of trying to make the right wing spot your own. But there's also that part of me that thinks until he leaves Palace, unfortunately, he will someday. He's not going to necessarily get the attention he deserves. But let's also talk about Adam Wharton because, I mean, again, we haven't had you on since he signed him, for God's sake. So I really want to talk about Adam Wharton more generally. A lot of the data shows that between him and Kobbie Mainoo, two very similar types of players, Mainoo is essentially the better dribbler, but in most departments, Wharton actually outclasses him. And a very well-deserved call-up that I wasn't actually sure would actually happen when you thought about the likes of Phillips and Henderson and other Southgate favourites. So I don't want to make this an England pod, but I want to make it about, how Palace players fit in here and where it takes their career. So talk to me a bit about Adam Wharton. Let's get to the point here. Talk to me a bit about Adam Wharton and talk about that call-up and, whether it's the right call, whether, he actually gets into more starting 11s than not. How do you see him fitting in that camp over the summer?
Yeah, well, we do have to talk about it, mate, because this is history for Palace players. So I'm sure Palace fans won't mind us, praising them all this time. But yeah, Adam Wharton, for me, actually, his shirt arrived in the post today. So that was lovely to get. Had to get
Keep
his
my
shirt. I just
shirt.
think,
Never mention that. Never
he's
mention it
just
on
different
socials.
gravy. I
No,
haven't
he
posted
is.
it at all. I haven't done clips of it or anything, but I like football shirts, just like you like Manchester.
I mentioned I live up north now. God, I'd never do that. No, the weather's shite. Honestly, it's. I say that it always fucking rains. People aren't joking about that. Like when I first moved up, right? Seriously, people were like, "Oh, you have a blast. It'll be fun or whatever." But they're like, "You do realize it's gonna rain all the time." It's like, "Oh, I'll be fine. I'll be fine." No, it's like. We had summer vibes for about 2 weeks, sorry, and now it's just bleak again. It's bleak for most of the bank holiday weekend, but like Sunday, it's a fun one. Right, I digress. Talk to me about Adam Wharton because seriously, it never rains, it pours at Palace, and for once you've got some sunshine. So let's talk about the sunny spell. Oi.
Oh, I love that. I love that. Yeah, he is amazing on the ball. Loves a forward pass. I think that's the thing I really enjoy about him. I just love the fact that his vision seems to be he knows where to pass it before the ball gets to him. And to do that at like 20 years old just seems ridiculous in the Premier League. To go from Blackburn in January to the Premier League and in that 6 months to become a player that literally all the media are talking about and to get an England call up just shows how good he is. And just huge props to everyone who got him to get to Palace. Must have bribed his dad a lot because of that player final back in 1989. But
And having walked the gauntlet of Greeny Gob or whatever it was, that was a Hall of Fame tweet. I'm still glad people take the mick out of that. Did we cyberbully that guy off Twitter? I feel like we collectively did, didn't we? Because he disappeared.
sadly think he did disappear, but
Yeah,
someone did like the save my quote, so I see his face come up every now and then.
it's
But
quite funny, isn't it? Yeah,
it happens, it happens.
just
But
comes with the
yeah,
territory. Yeah, I'm
he
sure his
is
dad's kicking himself about
amazing.
his son being called up for England. God, can you imagine?
I know,
Jesus.
man. I know.
One thing I like you say about his overall quality is I always love Wharton's ability to dictate tempo. We saw it against Wolves, as we'll get onto in person actually, but in every game I've watched him, I mean I watched him at Everton in person, I watched him at Wolves, I've watched him on telly all the time. But you even just with the eye test, you really see his ability to slow down and dictate the tempo. And this is something Southgate was talking about in terms of overall injury, because Bellingham and Rice, world-class players, they're nailed on. They are the heartbeat of this England camp. But there's always that third slot potentially there, depending on formation. There's certainly always the question of, right, if we lose Rice or Bellingham, and this is what Southgate was talking about. You know, if we lost, say, Declan Rice, it's like Bellingham and who, Rice and who comes in? Well, it's not fucking Beans or Pearce because we've not got anyone. So, you know, who partners Rice here? Seriously, though, it is got to be someone like Adam Wharton or Kobbie Mainoo. And it's a brilliant time for someone like Adam Wharton to be breaking through, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is. And I think actually, Declan Rice this season in the Premier League for Arsenal, his best games or most of his games are as a centre mid, box to box, you know, contributing to the goals and that. I actually think if we have to play him as a DM properly, it's going to restrict him a bit. Wharton, that perfect DM, you know, slide him in alongside him. He can sit, let Rice, you know, maraud forward, do what he does best. And I also think the Wharton-Mainoo comparisons. In terms of Maino and Wharton, they actually seem like completely different players sometimes. And I think the comparisons have come because Ten Hag's playing Maino as a DM. But every time I see Maino play a bit further forward, I actually think he's quite decent. So I actually think in terms of Wharton and the players he's got to compete against, there's not many. If you're looking at a proper out-and-out DM who loves a tackle, for me, it is literally just Rice. And obviously Rice is that starting player, but if you need that cover for Rice, for me, Wharton would be perfect, perfect on the bench down. I know he's young and he hasn't got that experience yet, but if you can squeeze him into the squad's been extended, you know, if you can squeeze him in, it would be ideal.
Definitely. And to be fair, I know you mentioned inexperience. You know, I have to admit that even as a you know, someone of his age, he seems to play with such maturity at the Premier League and
True.
such confidence. And I feel like, you know, there's always that chance, you know, playing in England, shirt hits different, being at the Euros with literally everyone in the country watching you on the telly, even people who don't like football, you know, everyone you grew up with, friends and family, you name it, watching, you know, there is that pressure. But if there's one player who I just think won't be fazed by it in our squad, it's him. I think actually, shout out to Ebs as well. I think he's someone who thrives really well under that pressure too. But I think Wharton is someone who I think, you know, everything feels like water off a duck's back. I think he's a very humble character and takes everything in his stride and the way he comes across. And I think he'll adapt seamlessly to the highest levels. Really, really interested to see in this England camp whether he can get his first caps in those friendlies. But you know, I still think he's so highly rated. I think he actually should be more of a shoe-in to make the cut ultimately. I think he's that good, and I think with midfield options increasingly dwindled. And you know, let's give credit. I'm not a big fan of Gareth Southgate, to be honest. But I will say he made a really, really good call in keeping Phillips and Henderson out, because I certainly thought the latter would make it for one. And I think he's had to make some very tough calls against his favourites there that I think have largely pleased fans and the media in favour of talent that I think is far more deserving and actually far more beneficial to be in that camp. So you know, really good there. But we must move on from England. I want to apologise to Dean Henderson because I know we did miss him a bit. But let's be honest. I mean, he's not playing over Pickford. He's not getting
He should be
minutes, I think.
third choice, isn't it? That's where he should be.
Yeah,
So.
there's a lot of competition there for one spot. And I think Pickford's not only for once he's had a phenomenal season. I think, you know, and even as neutrals, I think we probably underrate him a bit. But you know, he always turns up on the big occasions for England. I think that spot was always going to be his own so long as he's fit. But still, I think it is at least a testament to Henderson's upturn in form and his hard work to break into the team. And you know, I have to give shout out where it's due, but we've got to move on in the interest of time. Outside of England, obviously Palace look to have secured a deal for Moroccan international Chadi Riyad. We understand this is not the gay replacement. It looks like Maxence Lacroix is still very much our top target over the summer. Another deal that we're looking at quite closely, but we've had the Fabrizio Romano. Here we go. It looks like a 14 million pound, sorry, 14 million euro deal, I should say. Basically, Betis have a buy option on him, a very cheap one from Barcelona. They'll activate that and flip him for a profit with us. Looks like it's going to be structured in 12 million up front with a couple of million more in add-ons, but essentially the deal is done. He's expecting to sign a 5-year deal until 2029 in the next few weeks, and the medicals could be done very, very soon. How big is that? And do you think he's going to be good enough to really compete with us, or is he more kind of one for the future?
This is something where we have to check if we're all dreaming. We have to pinch ourselves because the season's only been over 4 days. Here we go from Palace are making moves this early, which is just ridiculous, and that needs a shout on itself. But in terms of Riyad, he's young, got potential, been in the Barcelona Academy. You know, they've definitely spotted something there. Lots of appearances this season, about 30, called up to the Morocco national team. It's an exciting signing, don't you think?
No, it has to be. You know, I have to admit there was some concern on my end looking at his FBref profile, and that's very much a superficial data nerd look at me, because he's not actually, I don't think that tells the full story, and there were some redeeming qualities too, but I think certainly aerially, from what I can tell, he's not the strongest. That's what I've heard from Betis fans too, that I was seeing on social media. But you know, he is incredibly young, and there's still plenty of time for him to develop. I think most encouragingly, from a strategic standpoint, this isn't the Gehi replacement, as I said. I think just going back to that point is really important here. You know, I think with Ward, and I mean, I know Ward and Klein are going to stay essentially, but for one more year at the very least. But you know, longer term, we do need to start planning for that right centre back position. And I think, you know, as far as youth prospects go, I think he's got a lot of talent, and I still think he's someone that can grow into that role. So I think coming in at a time where he's not got the weight of expectation to replace Gehi, and it's more just a useful prospect, is actually quite beneficial for everyone. So yeah, no complaints with the business being done this early. And I think it's a real credit to the other bit of news we have to talk about, which is, of course, Dougie Friedman. He's staying. That's another thing that we can, I suppose, with the benefit of hindsight, a few days after everything settled down, I think we can actually talk about this in more detail now, because we do know the facts. He's staying. We said in the last episode that it looked quite likely that he wouldn't, and we've got to eat our words here. The situation changed. He looked on the cusp of having a really formal approach from Newcastle, but he's turned it down to sign a new deal with a substantial pay rise at Crystal Palace. Just talk to me a bit about that, Luke, because there's so much to unpack there. You know, what's your reaction to the news initially? What's his overall legacy, and how important do you think that's going to be going forward?
Yeah, well, amazing news, like the best news we can have this summer. Because, you know, players will come and go. We kind of accept that, Palace fans. We accept we might lose a couple this summer, but it's all about the future recruitment. And the person who is so key to that is Dougie. You hear it in interviews from players who we have signed in the past who say he was so key. You see lots of people rave over him. There's a reason Man United and Newcastle wanted him. That's because he's good at what he does. And just a credit to all the signings he's got us in the past. I mean, people talk about the Dougie ID and even joking about Sorloth getting 4 goals against Real Madrid. So the Dougie ID is never defeated. So, you know, got to sh shout him out. It's been fantastic what he's done for us. I think everyone will forget the whole moving to Bolton now. I think that's finally done and dusted. He's done what he said in that documentary, stuck with us, realised that was a mistake. And to be honest, people are saying, why would he not go to a Newcastle or Man United? And I think it's because why would he not stay here, get a pay rise? Do what he keeps on doing and see if we can finish in that top 10 next season and maybe do better. Because in the space of 3 months, we've gone from no one talking about us to everyone thinking we've got some of the best talents in the division. So, and that is all credit to Dougie.
He's masterminded it in many ways. I think he has a good team around him too, let's not forget. And I think some credit has to go to Steve Parish himself. But you know, fundamentally, he's been the sort of the public-facing figure, the one who gets the deals over the line ultimately. I think the scouting, as Bobby said on the previous episode, the actual scouting and the sort of the groundwork is more escalated to him. But let's take nothing away from his influence in actually getting these things done. You know, he's the cornerstone of the progress we've made as a club in recent years. And barring a miracle, as you say, someone who I watched in person struggle against Grimsby in the cup is now going to, barring a miracle, win the La Liga Golden Boot. I mean, it's just insane. So, you know, I think his idea is fantastic. He's obviously got yet another new player over the line just recently. But, you know, all this recent success, all these great tools that Glasner's inherited is owed to him in many ways. So really good to see that. But without further ado, let's just take a bit of a breather, because I think, you know, it's been a bit of a whirlwind few months. We're at the end of the season. And I think, you know, just while I'm here, I want to give a shout out to everyone that's been involved in the pod over the last, you know, few months here and there. It's been an absolute journey. It's been a complete roller coaster of a season. You know, we're not going to do too many reflections today, but it's crazy that we at one point were just dreading the next week for football. Palace was something we actively just disengaged from, something we kind of didn't look forward to actually wanting the season to never end. I mean, it's crazy. And I think no other set of performances exemplified that like this Midland special that we're covering today. So look, let's just start with Wolves. I think it was a curious atmosphere going to that one. Really good to see you again, Luke, by the way, because I hadn't seen you since Sheffield. So, you know, first and last away game of the season. Really good to see you, mate. But I want to give a shout out before we actually look at Wolves itself to everyone involved with Palace for Life who did the bike from Selhurst. Phenomenal effort over 2 days. I bumped into DJ Jay Knox as well, which is quite funny. So really, if you're listening, Jay, good to see you. I know you're not probably, but you know, worth giving you a shout out. 33 people did the actual trek. I actually saw them coming through Wolverhampton at the home stretch, you know, going, "Eagles" on the way. So Really joyful. But seriously, what a tremendous effort. I think you raised almost 50K, probably more by that point now, actually, by the time of recording. But a phenomenal effort in terms of the overall funds raised that's going to help people across our community. So I want to give a particular shout out to the charity on the pod, because I think, the work they do is phenomenal. But yeah, talk to me about the atmosphere going into that game. I think obviously we're coming on in the midst of a really strong unbeaten run at this point, and I think, optimism is high in a way it's not been for genuinely for years around the club. But did you really expect us to win comprehensively, or did you think it would be a tougher one, Luke?
End of the day, it was such a weird atmosphere because it was funny. No one cared about the end result. I know it's end of season and stuff, but I think a lot of people would have thought after the fixtures we had just before Wolves and before safety was confirmed that that could have been a game that was going to be really crucial for us. But thankfully, it wasn't. I've never found a Premier Inn in the sunshine more fun than the away pub there. Really good atmosphere. Everyone was really enjoying it. But I didn't think it'd be like it was. I didn't think it'd be an easy 2-0. I know there was definitely bits of possession where Wolves were on top for sure, but even when they went 2-1, I wasn't that worried. It just felt a bit like, "Oh, go on then." And then we just turned the gear up again. It's like we just took a gear off, went back up when we needed to. Just amazing to see. Atmosphere was class. I think most people were chanting "Ole, ole" for about 90, 95 minutes of that, including probably the half time as well. It was just amazing.
Now, the atmosphere is phenomenal. I mean, like I say, at a personal level. And if you haven't done so, by the way, at thepalaceway.com, we actually did our end of season review there. But that will be different to the format that we're doing on the pod. It will be a very different style. But if you do want to read that article, check it out, because you had loads of contributors across the board. I actually earmarked that as my favourite game of the season. Nothing to do with the football, as great as it was. I think it was to do with the sentiment. I bumped into so many people I knew from, my time down in London, old neighbours I hadn't seen in a while. Really good to see people from the pod, see you. It's a great day in the sunshine, great atmosphere. Everyone sort of assuming we won at half time, which I think just sums up how far we've come this season as a club. I mean, it was just this rare shining through for me of optimism that made me think, wow, none of the data, none of the stuff we do online, we're just there. We're in the moment. We're watching football. We're doing what it's all about. It's about community. It's about the people we care about. And I think that really made it for me. So, I loved it generally. I think the atmosphere was brilliant, but just at the actual game itself, I mean, what I found really interesting between the clubs is that the average stats across the season are remarkably similar if you look on a per game basis. So Wolves average 11 shots to 90. We have averaged about 12, 49% possession for them, 42 for us. And all of this includes Hodgson's games, by the way, which will obviously, for the most part, dampen that. Their dual success rate is 47-50 for Wolves Palace, respectively. I know Glazer's outperforming the mean, but they've felt on the surface at least like two really similar teams coming in terms of the seasons we've had, fairly average at times, but very capable of an upset. So I think when we're coming off the back of this run under Glazer, I think it definitely turned the tables a bit. And I think the way in which the fullbacks were utilised was fantastic. So talk to me about the width in that game. I know it sounds like a really niche thing to talk about, but Munoz had a phenomenal game, didn't he? Mitchell, again, very solid. Talk to me about the way in which you've seen this wing play evolve over time under Glazer.
Yeah, it basically feels like Klein's the right back, Munoz is the right winger. Both of them are marauding up the pitch, and that's even with Elise as well. So you're looking at opposition, and they're like, we're dealing with three kind of very technical, well, Klein not so much, but technical or fast players here. The overload is ridiculous. Then if we need to, we got the left with Mitchell and Eze, and the right side is what amazes me so much because everyone's saying it, but Klein in this formation has been a revelation, and he's like 34, 35. And it's just really nice for actually us to see his career kind of take this trajectory that it has, come from the academy, left us, but come back. Never thought he'd be this important as he is. And when Gueye came back, there were actually shouts for Klein to keep his place, and Gueye has to fight his way back in, which just deserves such huge credit for Klein. But Glasner just needs that credit as well, for the way he creates this width with the players, and it never looks like we have issues when we get countered. There's obviously sometimes, but these players, these wing backs who will be in their 25-yard box, if they need to, they'll be back in ours in no time. And yeah, just huge credit. And it's just something we've never seen at Palace in terms of the tactics.
You talked about the feel-good factor. We've talked a bit about some of the tactical changes. I want to talk about some of the key match events now before we move on. I think obviously one thing that we didn't like to see was Will Hughes getting injured. He was only out for about 5 weeks, as it happened after the event. But at the time, I don't know about you, it looked horrific. It looked like he was really, really struggling to walk. I think he just about limped off. I think if it was a stretch job, we'd be in serious trouble. Nonetheless, a very speedy recovery to him. He's been a terrific servant who's really come under Glasner very well, really found a new height in terms of his recent form. So that's encouraging. But Hamada is someone we haven't really seen for a prolonged spell. I don't think we've even seen him come on in a first half under Glasner, particularly in that deeper role. What did you make of that decision? How did you think Hamada got an overall? And if you want to jump ahead, by the way, to the red card incident, feel free to, but we'll definitely cover that in detail too.
Yeah, so on Hughes briefly, just under Glasner, yeah, you're right. He's come on leaps and bounds and I was happy he re-signed. Happy the injury wasn't too long, but yeah, like you, I was a bit worried there. Ahamada now, you probably know he's someone I'm a bit of a fanboy for. I think he's got a future. Gotta remember, he is only 21, playing bit part games this season's minutes here and there. I actually thought for the most part it was a decent game. You're away from home. And it was nil-nil when he came on, so he got them two goals when he was on the pitch. Credit to the whole team for that, it is hard. Wolves have some good midfielders in there. Not saying he was perfect, not saying that at all. I think the red card kind of blinded his performance a bit in terms of what some of the fans thought. Seems like that was a bit reactionary after that red card. Red card came down, I think, a little bit to just a team shutting off. There was mistakes from a couple of players in the build-up, including him. Didn't realize he got booked for kicking the ball away. So I thought it was a straight red card. I don't know what you thought when you were watching it, mate. But yeah, I had a lot of confusion there. But overall, I thought it was a decent performance to come in, probably the most minutes in a game that he's got all season, maybe, and show promising signs. I do think maybe a loan move would be best for him next season, though.
Definitely. And I think it is depth dependent as to whether a loan move will happen. Just about the incident very quickly. I think it was the right decision. I just don't think it was handled or communicated very well on the pitch at the time, both to him and to the fans. I think looking back, absolutely. I think you've really summed him up there really well, so I won't dwell on that. Let's talk about the good stuff. Obviously, I think just even before the game kicked off, I think we saw that Jose Sarr had picked up an injury, so I was very encouraged by that. And I was with my brother at the time, and I just said to him, "Well, we're winning now." I think I was a bit doubtful beforehand. I respect Wolves as a disciplined team that does their homework very, very well, that digs in deep. They have a phenomenal record at winning the ball back statistically as well, so I was a bit nervous about that. But I think as the game got going and as I saw the keeper was injured, I was very, very happy about that. So 2 minutes of madness, 26 and 28 minutes in, Elise does what Elise does. Just take me through that, man. Talk me through that.
Well, to get the ball where he gets it, run outside the box, everyone knows where he wants to go, but you can't stop him. I think that's when you've got a top player. It's that similar thing, Robin loved to do, them left footers on the right wing, cutting in, getting that ball, curling it into the bottom or the top left corner. Lovely goal. But the whole build-up, mate, was ridiculous. I think so many players were involved. There was one touch passing again, Wharton passing the ball forward quickly, like we spoke about before. Munoz diving down the wing. It's really good to see, wasn't it?
Oh, it's phenomenal. I mean, we said a few episodes ago that I suppose a few episodes, probably quite a while now, actually, probably towards the January window. But I always said, even when Munoz hadn't yet signed, I was excited at the prospect of him linking up with Elise. But I never really felt we saw that come into fruition until maybe the sort of the real heyday of Glasner's reign at the moment, when we really started to get on this unbeaten run. And I think that goal was just one of many moments that exemplified that. And we saw it against United again, we saw it here. His ability to actually drive the ball forward, to come in on the overlap, and to then sort of actually drill in a little bit and actually cut inside and actually manage to kind of make more space, managing to kind of rearrange the pitch to suit him and to actually get that pass off. It's not just Elise that people step off of, it's Munoz as well. I think he's incredibly good at holding the ball up and actually finding space in the first place. And we really saw that. And I know Wharton will get the assist, but for me, it felt like an exaggerated version of that kind of, very famous Busquets layoff on the halfway line for Messi. It felt like he, and no disrespect to Wharton, he's phenomenal. He's made some much more acrobatic and agile assists and, done a really good job there too. But it didn't really take a lot of work for Wharton to let back off to Elise. Massive football cliche. But Elise is one of those players where you don't give him the ball, you sort of lend you lend it to him. He wants it back. You know exactly what he wants to do. And I think the way in which Wharton and Munoz in particular were involved in the build-up was ultimately fantastic. And to devastating effect, kind of struggle to think of why Elise gets this much space because United did it as well. It's like he's one of those players, a bit like Wilf in his prime as well. He's one of those players where it's like, I don't really understand why you give him so much space, but if Wilf can get crowded out, I don't see why you can't crowd Elise out. Are people too scared to concede fouls? I don't know. But you know what he's going to do. And if you let him do it, he does it. It's players like that that make you £100 million players, and I don't say that lightly because I think we get exaggerated and too excited as foot fans, but I don't say that lightly. That is the hallmark, as you say, of a serious player, and I wouldn't be afraid to put a price tag like that on him because, release clauses aside, I know that won't happen, but it's so beautiful to see, and it's such a rare trait that someone can get afforded that much space. But you can tell I'm going off on one here a bit. I'm romanticizing him. It was a phenomenal effort, and I think we're all too aware of his overall quality. And then something particularly strange happens, and something we don't really see often in terms of goals in quick succession. So talk to me about the big man. Talk to me about Big JP.
Oh man, what a revelation he's been under Glasner. And I think obviously we are recording this a few weeks after, but the second goal, Klein had the shot, didn't he, at first? And Mateta was in the right place, right time, if I'm right thinking.
Yeah, Mateta was in the right place at the right time. It's a proper poacher's goal, let's be honest. But I think Klein himself, I actually put it in our notes here, that Klein I felt was doing that as well. I mean, he did brilliantly to find the space in the first place, and so he was very unlucky not to score his first goal since returning to the club. I mean, it's a fine testament to how he's been that he'd get a kind of trick, like, collector's item like a goal. But no, very, very unfortunate not to score, to be honest, Klein to get on the post. But yeah,
Got him.
talk to me about his poacher's instinct, because I mean, it's been phenomenal for the big man this season, hasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I think the first two goals are just so much credit to Glasner and his system, like you were saying about Elise with the space. I think with Munoz and Klein pushing forward, Elise gets even more space than normal. Klein in the box. Klein is our right centre back and he's in the box for a counter attack. It's just ridiculous. It's amazing. Back in February, January, would he be in the right position, right time? I don't think so, but that comes with confidence. That comes with a manager believing in you. And it comes with a manager actually wants your team to score a lot of goals every game. And it's really, really helping our strikers and our attackers like Mateta. And it's really nice to see because, to be fair, I think he already would have got a little bit of a cult hero status for some of the goals he has scored for us over the years. But now that he's actually getting like 16 goals in a season, it's just cult hero cemented, isn't it?
Brian Barclays, I'm going to be honest, that the most amazing thing about Glasner isn't that he's got Palace winning games every week, winning by huge margins. That's amazing in itself. The most amazing thing is that we beat the Palace striker syndrome allegations, because oh my God, we've gone genuinely. When was the last time, like maybe like Prime Benteke that one season? Like, when was the
17
last
goals
time
or
we
something,
had?
wasn't it?
Yeah, exactly. It would have been what? Yeah, 16, 17.
That's
Yeah, it's
it.
like, when's the last time we had a striker that was in consistent form like that, that was scoring every other week, it feels, that was actually getting noticed for being prolific? I mean, we've had a lot of strikers that have been very much outside the top six. Think Watkins, think Solanke, think Isak, that have all been rightly getting plaudits for being phenomenal. And I think JP's up there. He's in those conversations. There's a good selection of strikers in the league, and he's very much one of them. People are talking about the trifecta, talking about the emo front three of Eze, Mateta, and Elise. I mean, it's something we don't really see. I think that's one thing that's been a real theme under Glasner, is this kind of inversion of what people expect from Crystal Palace. It's a total revolution of reputation. And I think as far as revolutions at the Palace go, this has been one of the better ones that we've had so far. So all I can say is long may it live, and let's hope there's not too much breakup in the summer. That's a separate conversation for the next time, to be honest, about the summer and who will leave and all of that. So we'll get onto that when we need to. But let's just enjoy what we have. And I think, to be honest, we talked about the red card incident. I won't spend too much time on that, but let's talk about Wolves' goal. I mean, I have to say, there were spells, particularly in the middle of the game, where Wolves generally, as I said, were bringing their reputation of winning the ball back to the fore. They looked a lot more physical and aggressive at times. I think they were able to break back into the game. So talk to me about their passages of play, and talk about that goal themselves and the VAR controversy there.
Yeah, I think they had like a 15-minute spell where something just felt like it was coming. The game was kind of getting into them last 20 minutes and they had to start turning it up a gear if they wanted to get back into the game. With it being their last home game of the season, I think a bit of caution went into the win from them. Really hard, really hard when you're just trying to defend and you're getting overloaded for like that 10, 15 minutes. I think a goal was coming. And yeah, again, it's so hard when you're in the stadium, isn't it, to understand what's going on with the VAR. And then when it takes ages, you're just a bit like, especially if it's an offside or something, in your head, you're like, it's got to be a tight decision. It's got to be really tight. And it just feels like the attacker should get the advantage in that situation if it is really tight. And look, it got the right decision in the end, I believe. So it did its job technically. But yeah, just the confusion in the ground is so annoying.
What was really bizarre is that I think looking back, it was right to give that goal. I think, Anderson was playing on behind, but by his heel, but it was so hard to actually gauge from the stadium setup that that was the case. And I think even I was right below the screen, and I must be blind because I couldn't actually see from the angle that they were showing in the ground how he was offside. And I think again, it's I'm tentatively in favour of getting rid of VAR. Another debate for another time, but I will say that it's definitely not the sort of the silver bullet solution. I don't think it's going to solve the problems people think it will. And I think there will be disappointment if and when it goes. But I have to say the consistency with which fans are turning on it is something not to be scoffed at. And it was quite funny seeing Wolves fans actually when they've been given a goal leading the sort of fuck VAR chants and then everyone joining in and creating a very clear message to all the officials at the stadium that they're not happy with the way in which the processes are being carried out. It was really, really interesting to see it from that perspective. Actually, I might give a shout out here to Wolves fans. I know it's going to sound a bit wishy-washy, but they were good crack. They were good fun. We started chanting, "He's just too good for you" about Michael Olise, and they chanted the same thing back because he's obviously going to outgrow Palace. And you know what? Fair enough. I hate to say it, but fair enough. I think there was some good interaction there, and probably one of the better atmospheres I've had at an away day, actually, because I've been to some shockers this season. Everton comes to mind in particular, Sheffield. Teams that are proper, that have good reps, but a phenomenal performance. I don't think it was perfect, but I think, a really, really terrific game football, topped off by some Eze magic. So talk to me about that, Luke, rounding the keeper, no less. Talk to me about the Eze goal, how that comes about, maybe Adam Wharton in the build-up as well.
Yeah, it was just a lovely counter and finding the space quickly. Eze running in behind, really good to see. And I think the big thing there was Eze one on one. He can miss a few if he's one on one. You know, he has done in the past. So to see him actually then have the confidence to go round the goalie, tap it in, was even better. And, you know, just to end the game and just a really nice goal just to top off a beautiful day in the sunshine.
Fantastic. I mean, to be fair, there's not too much to say for that goal other than it was simply a devastating counter attack and a devastating link up between two of our most informed players. And I think it really exemplifies the confidence that they exude when they get up onto a pitch these days. It was a fantastic way to pass from Wharton to find Eze to then drift around and actually manage to slot it past the keeper, only adds to the sort of panache that goal shows. And yeah, as you say, great day in the sunshine, most importantly. The football was fantastic, but that was more of a cherry on top for me. I felt like it was always going to be a day I treasure in a place I've never been. I know I can only get so excited about being in Wolverhampton, but it was a good stadium to tick off. And I've a little confession from me. I've been following Palace for years now, but I've not actually really done an away day since I left London. I'm gonna plug it again, aren't I? God. But yeah, it was. I think that is one advantage. I've got so many massive clubs near me. I've got both Manchester clubs. I've got Sheffield on my doorstep. Really, it's a tenner return for me. It's great. I've got the Liverpool teams. I've got going down a bit. You've got Villa. You've got Wolverhampton. You've got Forest. You've got so many good clubs. If Leeds come back up, I've got them as again about a tenner into Yorkshire on the train. It's like it's so nice to be able to do away days cheaply and easily for me. So CJ is our producer, if you're listening, very sorry. You're all the way in California, so very, very sorry about that. But I digress. We have to talk about Villa, of course. I was nervous for this one. Again, I always will be nervous for Palace games, but for some reason, and look, in hindsight, it's easy to say with the 5-0 with the kind of the piss up that was going on in Villa's camp. But Villa were definitely a success story of the season. Emery doing a terrific job there and obviously securing Champions League football on Wednesday. There was always a sense of Villa were going to be on the beach, hungover, turning up to Selhurst Park. But I mean, no one expected us to destroy them, did they, Luke?
Yeah, not at all. I thought it was going to be one of them score draws where, you know, both teams are having a bit of fun, but going to keep on saying credit to Glasner in this podcast because he's got them players with a mentality where they have to win every game. And you could just see that from the offset. Huge, huge shout out to Dean Henderson in that game because if he doesn't make that save to Diaby when it's 1-0, oh, when it's 1-0, sorry, completely different game, I think. And, you know, to get that and then to get the second and then, you know, yeah, as you said, Villa were enjoying their Champions League qualification, but still, they didn't want to get thrashed. You could tell that Emery, you know, he went straight to the dugout after, straight to the tunnel at the end of the game. You know, he wasn't happy. So, you know, to be able to demolish them like that, no matter them being on the beach or whatever, was a huge achievement. To get Mateta hat trick and just to get everyone playing so well was just great to see, especially when so many of our players are being linked away. If that was the last game for them, it was a really good one to send them off on.
Some way to end it. Again, football in the sunshine with the season we've had, or the end of the season we've had, I should say. I mean, it's just, I couldn't think of a better way to tie bows up and sort out loose ends. I mean, it's phenomenal. Before we get on to one particular fact that we're never going to stop talking about, unfortunately, let's talk about the Matata hat trick. We'll talk about Eze's goals as well, of course, but let's talk about the Matata hat trick because we haven't had one since Yannick Bolasie in 2015 away at Sunderland. I think that's our first home hat trick since in the Premier League, modern Premier League era. It's just absolutely phenomenal. It's just something that's a real treat to see. Very much a collector's item again. And I think it's been another theme under Glasner to not just beat teams, but to beat them comprehensively. But let's talk about those goals. Let's get back on track there. Like, just talk me through each one. Let's just start there. What actually happens? Who gets involved? We'll talk about the finishes as well.
Yeah, I think although Elise only picked up one assist on the day he ran that game, he was everywhere on the pitch. Crucial for all the goals, in my opinion, and just such a menace for Villa. Mateta, in terms of the first goal, the run in behind the defence, perfectly timed run. First time finish, perhaps, I think. Sorry, my memory's a bit hazy.
Yeah, you
But
can repeat that. Yeah, it was, yeah. Picked up from Elise. Bosh.
Mateta's conversion rate when he actually gets the shots off at the moment is ridiculous. Like, he is actually a finisher. Both feet sometimes, and yeah, it was just amazing goal, wasn't it?
We've said for ages that when Mateta doesn't think, he's at his best. And I think I'm actually going to challenge that. I'm serious this, Luke, because he is thinking more and he's actually becoming more tactically aware. He's working harder physically. He's working harder in the gym. He's working harder to build his pace up. And I think a combination of his hard work, his improvements, and I think that the tactical style from Glasner is meaning that when he does switch off and take those strikes, he's getting them right and he's getting them right with aplomb. And that's really why he's had such a meteoric turnaround in form and fortune under Glasner. In fact, the fact we're even talking about Mateta, matching records from Henry, potentially getting a France call up and being unlucky to miss out is phenomenal. Can you imagine talking about that at the start of the season? Mateta being linked with big clubs, Mateta being linked to replace Mbappe at PSG, Mateta being called up for France. I mean, it's just insane, isn't it? We're living in a simulation. But yeah, first goal, really well taken. Second goal, God, I mean, that was serious toe pokery to get it past Martinez, but talk me through that.
Like, you can have any player you have on the pitch and they perform well, but when it's a striker, I think it just hits the fan base better. And when it's a club like Palace, who, as you said earlier in the podcast, we struggle to get them strikers scoring, it's just even better. But yeah, to toe poke it, I think it went top corner from my angle, but to toe poke it past, get past a very good goalie, I know it's their sub goalie actually, Olsen, but still to do that, to breach that defence and just to be unplayable like Mateta was against Konsa, Diogo Carlos, Longley, all very, very good defenders in their own right, just shows how good he is at the moment.
It's thrown me back to his performance at home against Villa when he bullied Ezri Konsa. No, sorry, not Konsa, Tyrone Mings, apologies. When he bullied Tyrone Mings and just absolutely forced his way past the keeper back when he was shit. It's also just got me thinking that we started last season with Vieira as our manager. It feels like an eon ago that that was the era we were in. And yet, in such a short space of time, you've had such a roller coaster, right? It's just nuts to me. And of course, the third goal, phenomenal to see in the second half, him linking up brilliantly on the right-hand side with Munoz and Elisa getting involved in the overlap again. How often do we say that? And then managing to sort of take his time, actually slow the game down this time. No toe pokery, no quick instinctive finishes. He runs the tempo. He absolutely runs it. Slows play down, manages to break through the back line and coolly slots it past Olsen to get a hat trick. And I think the roar was, as phenomenal as it was, I think that roar was a little bit louder when people had realised what he'd done. I mean, we haven't had a hat trick in, well, actually, I take it back. We haven't had a hat trick since Plymouth away this season. So, maybe there is something in that. But oh well, really, really good to see. Tucks it under his shirt, proper pregnancy test stuff. It was really, really good to see at the end of the game from him. He loved it. Let's give credit where it's due to Ebbs as well. I'm going to wrap it up very quickly, unfortunately, not give him the time it's due. Two very good finishes. Very
Very
similar,
good,
actually.
yeah.
He shimmies and makes phenomenal runs and just breaks through the lines. Manages to really drag people out of position, which is something I think he's done this season particularly well. And then takes first time strikes with a lot of power into a similar corner as well. Two very similar goals, I should say. But nonetheless, I think it's really encouraging to see this front three having like a Wilf-like output. I think Zaha is, I love him to bits. He'll always be a club legend to me. He's not done anything to aggravate us either. But for me, he's proven how replaceable he was. And I've never thought I'd be saying that. And I wouldn't say that lightly, but he is. He's been replaced on the left and the right, and increasingly up front too. You know, the output is simply there now, in a way that we're just simply not reliant on one person like we were for so many years. I think we've had to kind of let him walk so that we could fly. And I think if we can continue this progress, I think, you know, Zaha will always be welcome. But I don't think we'll miss him in terms of on the pitch ability. We'll simply miss him as a legend of the club. I never thought I'd see the day, frankly, which is a shame. But you know, we've got there, and at least that's something to be savoured for now. Kind of hurried along there with Villa, which I feel was bad, but I think, you know, I think we need to capture the feel good here because it does sum up a phenomenal end to a gruelling season, but we all made it together, didn't we? But let's talk about one thing, Luke. You check the table.
I definitely got a glimpse of it on the big screen at Selhurst Park at the end of the game.
You know, people were calling us tin pot for that. I mean, what did you make of that? That was weird, man, because it's just the league table, surely.
Even if so, yeah, it's like we've had it from August to March where everyone's been writing us off. Lots of opposition fans have been saying we're going to get relegated. You know, lots of fans are saying, oh, it was just a blip. Oh, the Liverpool game was just because they were bad. Oh, all this, you know what I mean? And so to then get all the points we did, finish in the top half when we had no right to do so when Glasner arrived, was just a remarkable achievement. And, you know, if our sometimes noisy neighbours are going to call us relegation fodder and all that, and then we're going to finish above them when they're apparently onto the next big thing, then yeah, we're going to take a picture of the tight table and show our top half finish and not just care about our rifles. Just care about finishing in top half because, as a club who've been in the Premier League for a decade, we haven't done that enough. So it is a really good achievement from Glasner and all the players.
No, definitely. It's not only is it equal our best ever finish in the modern Premier League era, it also matches our, well, actually doesn't match. It actually takes us past our highest ever goal score tally. We're on 57 for the season. So in terms of entertainment value, I think it all comes at one end of the season for sure. But I think, you know, even under Roy, credit where it's due, there were an occasional few goals in there. You know, I'm thinking particularly against sort of relegation fodder, but you know, there were a few good goals there too. And you know, the combination of that is a hugely entertaining end to the season and some new records set in for the better. And I think as far as foundational half years go for Oliver Glasner, if that, I mean, what a better way to start it on. I think his methods are truly set in. And you know, with obviously Riyad coming in and more transfers to come, a few outgoings admittedly this time, but you know, there is a foundation being built here, and I'm really, really encouraged by the future, which is something that I feel like, again, like many things we say on every episode, because we simply have to. There's no other way about it. But you know, the way I see it with the screen, going back to the original point, is it's not Sussex by the Sea on the screen. We're not trying to encourage anything like that. It's purely spit and fact. You could go on any site, any chart, any table, and you'll see the same data. It's only what we will see anyway. If Brighton want to be shit, they can be shit. Great. I think De Zerbi's quietly had a disaster class end of the season. I think they fell off. All of
They
this,
were
you know.
17th, mate. When it came to the second half of the
True.
season, the 18 games, they were 17th on the table. And they can talk about injuries all they want, but there was a lot of that down to the managerial tactics and the setups. And really crazy to see. It's like if Palace go good, then Brighton go bad, and vice versa at the moment. Doesn't seem like two teams can be of a decent level at one time, but next season, maybe there'll be a closely contested rivalry match, and it could be quite exciting for both sets of fans to see how that plays out.
And like it's been like seriously funny to see De Zerbi leave, having spent half his career at Brighton twerking for like Bayern and a few other clubs, only for Vincent Kompany to somehow fluke the Bayern job. I mean, it's just phenomenal. That's serious shithousery. I want to give a special shout out to the Bayern board for just absolutely shithousing Roberto De Zerbi with a strange appointment there. But oh well. Did you see what Capello said about De Zerbi as well?
Yeah,
What, a
he
third
praised him,
division
didn't he?
manager? Yeah, it was crazy. Even I thought that was a bit brutal, but I don't disagree. I mean, I think he's been found out a bit. And I do want to, you know, say Brighton fans were moaning about injury, but we were blight with injury caused by Roy Hodgson, and we still managed to finish above them. You know, every team struggles with injury to varying degrees. You know, you think about Spurs, you think about Chelsea, they've both had horrendous spells themselves of injury at the top end of the table. And increasingly so, I should say, at the top end of the table, because Chelsea also had a very quiet but nonetheless strong recovery in terms of overall performance before they got rid of Park, which is baffling. This isn't a general football podcast, so I'm not going to spend too much time looking at other teams, but I do want to say that I think this idea that injuries is an excuse, it's not only something that is ridiculous generally because of how it affects most clubs to varying degrees, but you know, we've had crises ourselves. They're not the only ones, and I think they're not the only ones to have endured that and come through from it as well. So, is it a question of depth and losing their best players? That's not for me to say. This isn't a Brian pod, but it's a flimsy excuse at best. And I don't think it compares or stacks up any differently to us first and foremost. So nonetheless, I think it's just really satisfying to really just drink in that table position, because I know it's only a point, but we've had to suck up their swill so long. We've had to see articles being written by professionals very, very early on about them surpassing us. And I think that was true for a magnet at a time. But I think, eras come to an end and theirs crashed and burnt very quickly, pretty much after they got dumped out the Europa League and got shown up by Lacazette. So, it was just I don't know why they went gung ho on us like the way they did. I think I really just hope one thing, if I can end this kind of ramble about Brighton. I hope when Glasner gets us Europe, I hope we don't get so arrogant. I genuinely mean that. It's going to feel great. Like, we're riding the high at the moment. I really hope we don't let it go to our heads like it did for them, because there's every chance that one day it reverses again and Brighton do have a little blip ahead of us or whatever. Whether that happened or not, I hope not. I don't think it will in the foreseeable future, but anything can happen in football. So I really hope that we don't let any kind of moment of supremacy, something measurable, really go to our heads. We focus on us a bit more. Let's focus on our fortunes, our European journey. Let's focus on our memories. Let's not sort of just spend half the time gloating, acting like we're permanently going to be bigger than we are. We're in this for the long run as Palace fans. We have ups and downs. We're riding a wave at the moment. Let's just stick it out. That being said, a bit of piss taking is wonderful. So, boil piss, do your thing. Just don't let it go to your head. Don't get drunk on it. Don't start writing articles, guys, about how you're just better than them. We're better in spirit. We've always been better than them in spirit. That will never be taken away. But on the pitch, things change. Let's just enjoy it for our sake and not theirs. All right. And on that weird bombshell, I want to end on just a bit of a thank you, first of all, Luke, for coming on. But I want to give special praise to an unsung hero before we wrap up. CJ, I've mentioned him before, but he's our new producer. He's been with us for a few episodes now. So if the quality's gone up a little bit, that's why. He's does a lot of sound engineering outside of work. He's a serious pro, and we're delighted to have him on board with the podcast, helping us with our editing. So you can thank him for the crisp and dulcet sounds of me annoying your ears and irritating them on, well, whenever you're listening to it, be a dull Friday afternoon, be it whenever. So CJ, welcome to the air. Welcome to the stage. How are you been?
Pretty good. Thanks, Alex. I appreciate it. I love the UK snark. I never get used to it. I never get tired of it. It's absolutely class.
I love that. Sorry, I'm not going to take the piss, but yeah, that's a very British thing to say. I love that. So just tell us a bit about where you're from. Tell us a bit about your relationship with Palace, because we've obviously had Tampa Palace on before. You're not the first American to be on, and obviously you guys love raving about Captain America Chris Richards himself, who we didn't even talk about on this episode, but we could have. Let's talk about your affinity with Palace then.
Started back in 2018 through the kits, actually. So Zaha fan here. First chant I learned was the Zaha chant. And from there, I really admired EPL, just the entire league as a whole, how the top 20 teams play against one another, the camaraderie within certain clubs, say Brighton, and then also the derbies, the matchups. That's kind of really how everything started. I'm originally an MLS supporter with the LAFC side, primarily because born and raised in Pasadena, California. So I love football. I don't call it soccer. With Palace, it started with the kits, and then through 2020, the whole COVID year, I'm just kind of really going around seeing if I actually really like Palace or just like their makeup. And it was hard to root for any other club. I couldn't support any other club. I like the players that were on Liverpool. I like the players that were on Manchester. All of them are gone now. I couldn't support any other club. So I just watched and kept watching more and more Palace. And then I found a pub, which is Fox and Hounds here in Southern California, Studio City area. And that's where I watched the matches. And I've been actively supporting the club since last year. So it's been a long time, and I love being a part of something that's true, something that's real, something that's close to the heart. So I love being a part of South London.
Oh, good stuff. South Londoner from afar a heart. There we go, CJ. Thank you. That was a really good story, actually. As I always say, there's n you could support a team that wins every week. You know, you're going to get up at silly o'clock and follow Palace like the rest of us. But, you know, you could support a team that wins every week, like City. You could support a team that, as it happens, wins every week, like Palace at the moment. But we just know that that's not a historical trend. That's something that's set in stone, is it? So, you know, I always admire it when people go for different reasons for Palace, you know, with such choice available. So thank you very much for sharing. And thank you again for all your hard work. CJ, you wanted to tease a bit about the next few episodes to come. So rather than me doing all the talking about, you know, the admin and the life stuff, talk to us about what's coming next.
Going to be taking a break a little bit, and we're going to come back with a season review with the full writing team, or as many as possible, at least five plus. Plus, of course, Alex, I also will be joining on the pod, and then we're going to follow up with a season preview of next year, which is going to be the following one. So, yeah, it's going to be a really good podcast for the next two shows.
No, definitely. And in amongst all of that, of course, we'll have all the latest transfer news, gossip, and more. As we know, it looks like by the next time we record, Riyad will probably be a Palace player. Don't want to set that in stone because obviously it might not happen. He could fail his medical, heaven forbid. He could just not be there over the line just yet in time. But you get the point, you know, football moves quickly, and we're not going to pretend to know it all. As I said earlier, that's my point about Brighton here. It's like, absolutely take the piss, boil them up. I love it. I live for it. I love a bit of shithouse. It's what makes football football, and very uniquely British, unfortunately, CJ, in many ways as well. But we do it really well. So please don't take my kind of, you know, don't get too big for your boots as a kind of, you know, don't piss off Brighton fans. You know, do it. What I'm saying is don't set anything in stone. That was my point there. Like, I want to kind of clear that up before people start at me on Twitter. You know, we're here for our ride. We'll leave them in the dust sometimes, sure, you know, but we're always going to have what we love about Palace. We're always going to be bigger in soul. That was my kind of closing emotional ramble. It'd be nice to have a lot of people on as well, because I feel like I get sick of filling the void sometimes with my own voice. So I feel like I owe you an apology, Luke, but you were phenomenal, Luke. Really loved to chat, really loved your analysis and getting your thoughts on there, because I think you speak for many of us. Thank you for coming on. I'll wrap it up here, but dear listeners, thank you very much. We made it together, and what a way to make it. Thank you so much for all your love and support over the last season, and the last few episodes in particular. We've had a phenomenal reception, and you guys have really, really made us persevere through that all. If you're not doing so, please follow us on socials, particularly X at the Palace Way, exactly as how you'd expect it. And if you haven't done so already, please, please, please check out thepalaceway.com. We've built a fantastic user experience for you guys. We've built our own Wordle game. We're putting out quality analysis and articles all the time from our dedicated team of writers that we think you'll love. So there will be something for you there. Please check it out. We really, really hope you'll enjoy it. And all that's left to say, Luke, is thank you, and thank you for coming on. Any closing thoughts?
Yeah, cheers, mate, and cheers to everyone who listens to the Palace Way and all that. And here's to a lovely summer, enjoying the Euros, and we'll see you next season.
There's one thing I recommend. Please have a beer for us. Honestly, make the most of it. You know, the sun's barely out up north. I don't think London's much better. So, you know, enjoy it. Just enjoy it. Stay safe. The episodes are going to get more infrequent, but we've got really good plans for them. So we'll keep you posted. I really just want to give one last thank you. I know I say it all the time, but it's been phenomenal. I think reflecting on the fact that we have done our last episode covering games of the season, at least, is a nice moment for us. It's our first full complete season of covering every game across the season. So really, really good to have made it with you. So thank you for being part of our journey. Enjoy the summer, stay safe, and up the Palace.